You're listening to Seminary Dropout, and I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. In cooperation with MissioAlliance.org, straight from my house in Austin, Texas to yours, interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers, because good theology should be for everyone. This is Seminary Dropout. Let's go! My guest today is Tish Oxenreiter. Tish is the author of Notes from a Blue Bike and Organized Simplicity, and is the founder of the community blog The Art of Simple. She's the top-rated podcaster of The Simple Show, and her writing has been featured in The Washington Post, CNN, Real Simple Magazine, and more. A graduate of the University of Texas, where she studied English and anthropology, Tish currently lives, where else, in Austin, Texas, with her family, where they eat tacos several times a week, like any good Austinite. Tish, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
So your new book is called At Home in the World, Reflections and Belonging While Wandering the Globe. You and your husband decided to take a year-long trip around the globe with your three children. That is like crazy ambitious. What did your husband came up with the idea first, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we both kind of have this travel bug in our DNA because we met overseas doing work in Kosovo. And so we always knew from the start of our family that we would have some sort of interest in raising our kids globally. And we then lived in Turkey for 3 years as a family beforehand. And when our oldest was five, our middle was two, and I was pregnant with our third, we moved back kind of unexpectedly. And it was while he was a newborn and we were both sort of mourning the loss of what we had raising our kids, cross-culturally and a little bit as expats, that Kyle came up with this idea of like, just because we live stateside now doesn't mean we can't still leave and go do cool things. So that was the impetus of the idea, but it definitely took several years of planning before we actually did it.
And you guys you're kind of, you're situated to be able to do that because you had jobs where you could travel and work remotely, basically. I mean, you're a writer, and I understand that Kyle's job was one that he was able to do from wherever, too.
Right. And that's one of the big reasons why we went when we did, because we thought, well, we don't know how long we're going to have this ability. You know, I mean, it's a very cool situation to be able to work from anywhere. Let's take advantage of it now. So, yeah.
I guess your kids had, at least the older two, had some experience. I mean, they probably didn't know any different when they were growing up in those first few years in Turkey, being able to be flexible in a culture that at least wasn't their parents' culture, maybe different from the culture at home, so to speak. I think that's the thing that would keep most people from doing this. I mean, I can't make it through like a trip to Costco with my 3.5-year-old without a meltdown. I can't imagine like going across the globe.
Yeah, that's what most people say. And I totally get that. And it also doesn't mean our kids aren't normal. They also hate running errands, or they get bored in the car, or they ask for screen time all the time. So our kids are very normal. And yet they have had a lot of experience traveling. So the argument I make usually is the more they travel, the better travelers they become. So a lot of times people superimpose what they already know of their kids and imagine what it's like to travel extendedly for a year. And I make the case that honestly, the more they do it, my kids aren't anything special, basically. Just give them lots of opportunities and you'll be surprised, most likely, honestly, really and truly.
Well, I mean, when I travel, the thing about traveling, it requires long hours of a lot of times of sitting still, of going without sleep, and sometimes going long times without regular meal times. Those are things that make adults cranky, too.
Right. Well, you know, the two things I say to people is that whenever we think about these big, huge, the big, huge trip we took, and people imagine what it's like with their kids, the thing to remember is once you're already out there, it's easy to keep traveling. So yes, the long haul parts are pretty challenging, you know, I mean, for anybody, you know, it's hard to sit still for that long and to be all jet lagged and stuff like that. But once we made it through our first week of jet lag in China, and we just kept going, it was much easier to like, okay, now we're just going to move on through China. And then we're going to go into Southeast Asia, because you're already out there. And then the other thing is that I really do believe there are windows of time when it is genuinely hard to travel with kids. You know, our youngest was four when we left, and there was a reason for that. it's hard to travel with little kids, I think. You know, I think the hardest age to travel is age 1 through about 3.5, because they still are really needy. A lot of times they're still in diapers, and yet they have, you know, they're very exploratory, yet they have no filter. So it really is hard to travel then. So I legitimately agree with you there.
Well, and I think about it, obviously, in my own context, and my oldest is 3.5. So I think you probably turn a corner when the youngest child is old enough to walk by themselves all the time. Like, you know, carrying them is no longer an option. That would probably help a little bit.
Absolutely. Honestly, we see a night and day difference between even just age 3 and 4 when it comes to traveling. It's like suddenly our kids know how to handle themselves on an airport or airplane. You know, they don't go nuts. I mean, yeah, they're still kids. They still pull down the tray table more than they should, and they still kick the seat in front of them. But you can at least somewhat have a conversation with them and like somewhat reason with them and tell them, don't do that, and here's why. But yeah, the reason we waited until our youngest was 4 was because we wanted everyone out of diapers, and we wanted everyone to carry their own backpacks. And so that was a big milestone as well. And yeah, I mean, he still wanted to be carried sometimes. We still had to carry some of the kids' backpacks when they were exhausted. So it wasn't like they're like dream travelers, but the good still outweighed the bad for sure.
Well, you mentioned that you would go to China first. That was the first stop. And then you kind of visit other areas around Asia in the beginning. And one of the things that you mentioned was just the differences in different places in Asia. We're so bad about thinking about other groups as being homogenous, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, we understand that we kind of all don't get along and we have a lot of differences, but we think of every other cultures as a monolith. And I wonder, you talked about going from China to Hong Kong. And I wonder what were some of the just striking differences in the cultures there?
Yeah, you know, we're so bad at that. You're exactly right. And China is such an overpowering, oversized country in Asia that it's easy to superimpose what it's like there with all these other smaller countries, and even Hong Kong, which is part of China technically,
right.
But it's got this long storied history of being part of the British Empire until 1999. It wasn't that long ago. And so there are still so much of European culture in a weird sort of infused way of Asia that it has a lot more to do with mindset than it does sort of the lay of the land. And so the difference in just thinking a little bit more democratically versus communist made a big difference in things like how stores operate, you know, how you interact with the shopkeeper, what to expect in terms of internet access, how to look people in the eyes you walk down the street. And it's definitely not a bad versus good. It's just a different. And, you know, me coming from a democratic country, I was reminded, you know, this was not my first time to China, but I was still reminded of how much that is a value of mine. And I didn't realize it till, you know, I'm in a predominantly communist country where it's just not a value. The group think there is so palpable that I was so stretched in my, like, what I thought were my rights. You know, it was, you know, I mentioned in the book that we jumped into the deep end by going to China first. And it definitely felt like that, you know, it's like, well, this is probably the most different it's ever going to be, more or less, you know, when it comes to at least mindset for the rest of the trip. And it turned out to be pretty true.
One of the like uncomfortable things was how the people in China reacted to your children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, they're blonde, mostly. Our youngest is brown headed brunette, but the three of them still got so much attention. And because of that lack of personal rights mindset, they were photographed all the time. You know, we used to live in Turkey and we were used to them getting a lot of attention, but people didn't just take pictures without even asking.
Yeah.
And it was a stressor for me to feel, you know, as a mom to protective of the kids, yet also wanting to be culturally appropriate. There was a tension there for a while. And so after 3 weeks of this or so, I was ready to just not have to think about that all the time.
So I was telling you before, I recently just got back from a trip to Sri Lanka, and that was one of the places you went. And one of the things that you brought up was their airport. And it was so funny to read your words that were like exactly our words, because for some reason, and I haven't traveled a lot, so I thought maybe there's a lot of developing countries' airports that look like this. But after you deboard the plane and you're exiting the airport, there's like a strip mall of, I mostly remember electronics, like, and or like appliances, like refrigerators, washers, dryers, things like vacuums and stuff like that at the airport. It's the strangest thing.
Yeah, honestly, I have traveled quite a bit and I've never seen that anywhere else. So I'm sure, you know, it's not just Sri Lanka, but it was so strange and disorienting, I think, because I just wasn't expecting, you know, washers and dryers. Like, I try to wrap my brain around the logistics. You know, you're dealing with luggage and those trolleys with your bag stacked high, and suddenly you see a sale on a refrigerator. I just can't imagine, like, oh, let me pick one up. So I don't know quite who they're target market is for that, but hey, you know, there's apparently it works because there's like 20 of those stores.
You're right. Yeah, there's got to be some logic to it. I mean, maybe perhaps because that's a country where not everyone has those things there, so right. You know, maybe perhaps like in our airport where they sell expensive things, maybe that's what's going on there too. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe so, who knows. And maybe, you know, people from India go there and maybe, I don't know, maybe there's like a better price or something to do with the taxes. I have no idea.
Yeah, but there's some internal logic there. And the funny thing was, when we got there, it was like midnight and they were all open still.
Oh, funny. Yeah. Oh, great. That's hilarious.
Yeah. I mean, it was like, you would thought it was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon or something, but it was in the middle of the night and they're just all open. All the shopkeepers are standing out there ready to sell your refrigerator or something.
That's so funny.
Did you guys like Sri Lanka? I know that was kind of a... you didn't get to spend tons of time there, and it was kind of, you felt like you kind of hadn't cracked the culture there.
You know, we really liked it, and we can definitely look back in rose-colored glasses. We can see the good from it, but I think one of the challenges is that we were consistently tired the whole time, and the reason is because the purpose of us going there was just to see it. Like, we didn't have any connections there. We didn't know anybody there, and we were passing from Australia to Uganda, and it's not exactly on the way, quote, but it sort of is in that we were flying over it. And we thought, well, when will we ever get to go to Sri Lanka again? And Kyle had been interested in that kind of culture. So we thought, let's just try it. And so it was just disorienting because we were there such a short amount of time that we didn't have a chance to truly get over jet lag and to catch our breath and things like that. And, you know, because we were going to spend more time in Africa and we knew some of the people there, I think we were just thinking more about Africa from Australia. And so when we landed in Sri Lanka, it was a bit like, whoa, what do we do here? What is this? You know, but it was still fun. I mean, we can look back and laugh and it was enjoyable. I love the food. The people were very friendly. It was beautiful. It was super beautiful. I mean, I really, really liked it. I just did feel like we barely scratched the surface on it there.
One of the things that I was thinking about was when, you know, normally when people take a trip overseas, and for the length of time that most people take a trip, you know, like 10 days, 14 days, something like that, you're kind of sucking it up and just not resting. And you're kind of like soaking in all you can because your time is so valuable. But that's not really something you can do when you're taking a year long trip around the world. You've got to stop and take days off where you don't do anything like that. Was that hard to do?
That was our favorite part of the whole trip, honestly, because when we would see so much stuff, Kyle and I had the saying, when everything's awesome, nothing's awesome. And we would notice that kind of seep into our veins some whenever, you know, we were in Kenya and on safari and I was just amazed by some of the things and the kids would be a little like, yeah, that's cool, you know, and then move on. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, you guys, you have no idea how amazing this is. And it kind of hit me. They've done a lot of amazing things already this year. And so even now when you ask them what their favorite parts of the trip were, they'll usually comment on the places that we stayed someplace longer. So we planned the trip to have 3 slow times. We parked in Thailand for 6 weeks, Australia for 5 weeks, and France, southern France for a month, and then we went back later. And those 3 times are some of their favorite places, and that's a good life lesson for us, I think, you know, about what is life really meant to be about. And we really, truly appreciated those slow times where we just, yeah, of course, we'd still go see and do things, but on a more local level and in a slower pace. And that's when we just caught up on work and school and lived life and went to the grocery store. And to me, that's just as culturally interesting, honestly, as seeing the big sights. I mean, if not more so, because you're living among the people, you're getting a feel for, like, I honestly think going to grocery stores or supermarkets are some of the more eye-opening parts about a culture. You can see sort of what matters to them, from like the type of food to how it's displayed to the labeling. I just think it's all interesting. So we still got a lot of cultural experience stopping, but man, those times made the trip possible. I think we would have lost our minds had we not had those times.
You found that there were a lot of expatriates in Thailand. Why do you think that is?
I think because, well, first of all, it's cheap to live there.
Yeah.
It's the cost of living is really low. And it, out of that whole area, it's one of the only democratic countries. And so they are friendly to more of a Western sensibility. And because there's enough expat community there, there's a lot of English spoken. Mm. And I think people appreciate that. We met everything from, honestly, Vietnam vets who were still living in Southeast Asia all that those years later, and this was home to them.
Yeah,
all the way to a lot of these 20-something digital entrepreneurs who were just like living wherever they wanted and working out of coffee shops. And then, honestly, there were even quite a few families who lived there that were working somewhere in Asia, like maybe the husband or the wife had some kind of job in Asia, and this was the quote easiest place to raise a family. And there are a lot of English-speaking schools there. And so it was just an interesting kind of a infusion of, this is an Asian country. This is, you know, their homeland. And yet there's a lot of expats here. So, yeah.
You visited several African countries. And I wonder just about this and about your whole trip concerning this. But it seemed like Africa really helped in this regard, but just experiencing a sense of community. Because I think that when you're traveling that long, you have your family, which is a really great thing. But I would imagine that it would be difficult to experience community broader than that. And it seemed like Africa was a really good place that kind of helped meet that need for you.
Yeah, you know, I did not know at the beginning of the trip that the biggest lesson I would take away, and ultimately what the book is about, is the need for community, and that in community is where we find where we belong, is where we're at home in the world. And Africa, these, you know, of course, here we are talking about a monolith again. Africa has tons of countries, in fact, more countries than any other continent, and they're all different. So it's not like all of them are the same, but an overriding theme we found in Ethiopia, Uganda, Kenya, Zimbabwe, all these places was the hospitality, the welcoming attitude to foreigners, and just the love they have for each other. And of course, this is not to paint a picture like everything's perfect in these places, not at all. But I was still surprised at how much they worked in tandem with each other in community, and just both loved each other and welcomed us, like truly, genuinely welcomed us as visitors. They were so honored that we would come to visit their country just to learn more about it, just to experience it. We had so many people thanking us for bringing our kids. Mm. And that was just such a great eye-opening experience of like, wow, do I do that whenever I am talking with people and living in my community? So that has stayed with us for a long, long time. We loved it there. And it honestly surprised us probably more than any other place.
You saved Europe for last. Is that because it's the most expensive?
Partly. Well, so the original plan of the trip, honestly, was to do South America in between Africa and Europe, which I know seems convoluted if you draw a line around it. But we were planning on kind of following the sun and creating somewhat of an endless summer, or at least spring. And a lot of that was for logistics reasons, you know, just packing. We didn't want to have to pack parkas and, you know, all that stuff. But then when we had to nix South America, which was mostly for money and time a little bit, we realized, okay, we're going to be up in Europe starting in February. So we had to buy some stuff up there. But nonetheless, we ended it there partly because we needed to start in Asia for visa reasons with China and also following the sun, but also because we thought we're going to be tired. And we had some friends who had done an around the world trip the year before us, and they went the other way. They ended in Asia, and they said that they think they would have appreciated Asia more if they were more rested and also appreciated Europe more when they were tired. Mm. And so we found that to be true. It was almost like, I mean, it's not to say that not all the cultures were amazing, because they were, but in some ways Europe kind of felt a little bit like the dessert, you know, because I mean, it's Italy, it's Paris, it's those kinds of places. And yes, also it helped us temper our budget, because I think Europe is so expensive that we wouldn't have had the right mindset in terms of how to make this, how to stretch our dollars correctly.
You mentioned Africa, the continent, being one of the biggest surprises, just their hospitality. What other country was just maybe not what you were expecting it was going to be, either in a good or bad way?
We, and I loved Croatia. Croatia, I had heard about before as being just this, you'll be really surprised. You won't believe it. It's going to be so much better than you imagine. And yet I still wanted to go. So I thought, well, how great could it be? I was really genuinely surprised by it because, first of all, it's Europe and it's Mediterranean, yet it hasn't been overtaken by tourism and it's still pretty cheap for European standards. And so it was a great place for us to experience just genuine scenic beauty. Like, it is phenomenally beautiful and just rich, rich history from the Roman Empire all the way to, you know, the Balkan conflict. And then the people are so friendly and just thoughtful and genuinely warm. And there's a lot of English spoken, so that was helpful, especially when we were kind of getting tired of sure. that kind of thing. And as entrepreneur and kind of a digital nomad lifestyle, it was nice because internet worked great there. And it was surprising how many countries the internet was genuinely unpredictable, places that you wouldn't think. I mean, it's obvious, you would think so maybe in like Uganda, but Australia has terrible public Wi-Fi. France has terrible public Wi-Fi. And yet here we are in Croatia and there's Wi-Fi everywhere. And they'll
that
let
is
you
surprising.
Just, it is surprising. So that was a fun surprise. And we would love to go back for and spend considerably more time in Croatia, just kind of soaking it up there.
Well, I think I lose my podcaster's license if I don't ask you how this experience changed you.
Well, it changed me in the way I didn't expect. Part of it, you know you're not going to go into this thinking, well, my wanderlust is going to be quelled. I won't want to go anywhere anymore. Of course, that doesn't happen, because we know from experience, those of us who enjoy traveling, that the more you do it, the more you want to do it. And as soon as you check something off the list, something else shows up. So in some ways, I knew that was going to happen. But the thing I was surprised about was how much I learned how much of a homebody I am, and that those two things can exist in one body. And not only are they not a paradox, they actually kind of play into each other and are two sides of the same coin, that I love to travel because I also love being home and vice versa. And that in some ways they're birthed from the same place, which is, I think, the search for the ideal that I think is pretty God-given, and that we're not going to find it this side of heaven. And so instead of trying to like cure both of them, you know, make my home perfect and also travel to absolutely everywhere I'd want in the world, instead just lean into that tension, lean into the idea that we're always going to want more. We're always going to search for more and more, and just to be okay with that's never going to be satisfied, and instead just enjoy the moment for what it is. And so for me personally, I'm continually surprising myself how much I'm just enjoying being home more than I used to. I think before I realized this, I was always feeling like something better was on the other side. You know, the grass is greener kind of idea. And since we've been back, which is almost 2 years now, I still love to travel. I still always have these ideas of where I want to go next and what I want to explore. But in the meantime, I'm happy where I am. And that's a new feeling for me. It's been great.
Well, I think a lot of travelogues will glorify travel to the point of kind of shaming home, if that makes sense. And,
yep.
And that was a point that you kept driving home, was just that how the important one, that you realized in yourself how important home was to you and just how significant of a place it is in people's lives.
You know, one of the best compliments I've gotten, I feel like, from the book is when people say, I started reading this assuming I was going to want to just like toss everything out the window and run to the airport with my family. And instead, it actually made me grateful to be at home and just to really enjoy living vicariously through the book, but yet not necessarily feel the need to just go out. And I thought, that's actually great. That's what I wanted. I don't want people to read this and think, why can't this be me? Or, you know, if only our life were different in these three ways, and instead just really genuinely appreciate where you are and appreciate the world for what it is, I think there's no better compliment. And so, yeah, I mean, I think there's something of that truth in all of us, whether we lean a little bit more on the homebody way or the wanderlust way. I think we all feel a little bit of that. And just whenever we can find the peace to be wherever we are is a good thing.
And I think we all know people who, I think you said it really, really well. Like, we think that whether it's maybe not even like temporary travel, but just like just moving around, even in the States, there are people who think that like happiness is going to be on the other side of the next move, you know, and never seem satisfied. And at some point you kind of stand back and say, I don't know if geography is your problem.
Yeah. You know, near the end of the book, I talk about the Benedictine vow of stability. And I quote, I can't remember what the statistic is, but basically as a culture, we move more frequently than we ever have. And I think there is something in that of this idea that, okay, life is going to be better once I move to this city, or once I live in this part of town, or once I have this type of house. And the vow of stability is basically, and Thomas Merton, who is a Trappist monk, he talks about it as though the monk chooses to stay where he's put, and it's with the understanding that it really doesn't quite matter where you live, and that the nuns of Our Lady of Mississippi Abbey have this great quote where they talk about you're choosing to get rid of the thing inside of you that's basically desiring the ideal. And I just thought that was so wise and thoughtful. And I can't stop thinking about this vow of stability and what it looks like for those of us who don't necessarily take literal vows, but maybe perhaps are always thinking the better thing is around the bend, and instead choosing to just reflect on where we are right now and what does it mean to be all here.
Irony of traveling, especially internationally, is that you're experiencing cultures most of the time that they themselves do not travel and or at least don't move around. Like most cultures, it's you are born in a place and you stay in that place for all of your life. And you may have generations of your family living in the same house that also live there as well.
Yeah. You know, I say this in the book, but one of the things I wanted to experience in all these places is just see all the tiny places in the world, you know, all these tiny places where, you know, who makes the best bread in this town? What are the sauces like here? What are the people, just really what is day-to-day life like? Because that is really where the bulk of humanity just parks and spends its time. Yeah. The village in southern New Zealand, those people there almost never go to, you know, Fez, Morocco, where they explore the giant, you know, the largest, oldest work-live community in the world. And yet, I mean, they're both valid and they're both real, and it's both where real life is lived. And I was struck by the differences and similarities, and that honestly, there are far more similarities between them all. And that's just because most of us have a very similar ordinary life, work, school, just, you know, making things happen at home with laundry and cooking and all that stuff. It really is the bulk of humanity. And that's where most of our life is lived. It was really interesting.
What was the experience of coming home like?
That was way harder than traveling, partly because it was about 3/4 through the trip when we decided, instead of returning back to Central Oregon where we lived, we're going to actually move back to my hometown of Austin. And so that part itself, the decision wasn't hard, but it was hard to re-enter and to figure out where we belonged. Austin, as you know, has changed a lot. And so we knew that it wouldn't be like when we lived there before, which was honestly before Turkey. And yet it was still surprising how much of that reverse culture shock we experienced. We already knew it was going to happen because of having lived overseas, but it was really surprising how hard it was just to be okay with a lot of how life is lived here stateside. We're fine now, but the reentry part was really rough. And our friends that had done this trip the year before, they did suggest to us, have some things in place that you don't have to do from scratch. Like if you guys are going to sell your home, make sure you just keep your car, or, you know, just don't get rid of everything to where you have to start all over. And I thought that was really good advice because it was hard to figure out where to live next. So it was nice just to not have to think about some of those basic life things.
That's also an experience that is hard for people around you to understand fully. you know?
Yeah, you look the same, you know, talk the same. And yet for them, they don't really know what to say. And, you know, I largely understand on their end of things, like you did something so crazy, you know, whether that's going just on a shorter cross-cultural trip, they want to hear about it. They want to tell you that they value you, yet they don't know how. And so part of what we did on the trip that we value, and we still do this some, is we did our own debriefing. We did a personal, we have this list of questions that we started asking ourselves and our kids in a very organic way. It wasn't like we sat down and said, okay, kids, we're going to now debrief. It was just as we're walking through the park or just chit-chatting about our trip, and just start asking these questions to help us process them, because we knew coming in that people would not know what to say, or that it would be the same three questions. You know, what was your favorite country? What weird food did you eat? And, you know, usually something about like what we packed and how did we manage to only have like three t-shirts for the year or something. But people didn't want to know about like who was the most interesting person you met in Zimbabwe. Yeah. Or what was it like to live in a French village for a month? What was like your three life lessons? People aren't going to ask those things. So we asked each other, and that really helped.
I'm curious about how you wrote this, because it's so well written and there's so many details that I assume that you wrote a lot. And did you come back from each day and write something, or what was your process like?
I actually did not even start the book till we came back. Yet I thought I was going to write it on the trip, so I was fully prepared to start writing. What I ended up doing, though, is I just journaled a lot, and I took notes about what we did, what were my initial reactions to certain things about the day, without trying to interpret it or have it mean something. Because I learned, I mean, honestly, the second week of the trip, we were in Xi'an, China, and I remember specifically sitting down with my journal and realizing I'm not going to write this year. Like, I'm going to have to wait till we are done traveling, because I needed space. I needed distance from China to even know what I thought about it, to know what my experience was. And so I mostly just cataloged what we did so that I wouldn't forget it, yet also kind of had a few little kind of asterisks to it. You know, here is where Reed made this astute comment about stuff, and I think that means something, that kind of stuff. And so we got home, we settled into a rental house in Austin because we wanted to figure out where we wanted to park permanently. And then I just started typing as fast as I could to remember all this stuff. And it went through several drafts, because the first draft is never good, you know, but I wanted to just dump everything out of my brain before I forgot it.
Right.
And then I slowly worked on it for honestly, like, gosh, 6-7 months still. And so that part of the writing, I say, was my final leg of the trip, because I needed that to process. I needed that. It was like therapy, and it made the trip kind of come to a full stop for me as writing that book.
That makes so much sense to me, because when I'm experiencing something, what I want to do is to just kind of let that experience wash over me without documenting it at the same time, if that makes sense.
Yep.
I mean, even so much, I just got back from a conference, and it's funny because there are people around me taking notes, and I don't want to do that. It's not natural for me. I want to take it in, what I take in, and let the things that I remember be significant because I remembered them, and not worry about the documentation process along the way.
Yeah. And I think sometimes we can inadvertently make it end up meaning something than more than we meant. And I think a big, when it comes to travel or just honestly making memories or our childhood memories, when you think about it, we don't remember the details as much as we remember how it felt. You know, we don't remember the Christmas gifts. We remember how Christmas felt in our home. And same with, you know, family vacations. For me, I wanted to remember like, okay, we did this at this time, you know, just so I wouldn't forget. But I wanted to look back and more process the whole and like the kind of macro view of Australia and not the micro, because I wanted to know ultimately how it would, you know, and I don't mean like feelings in a woo-woo way. I mean, just more like feelings like what was the big umbrella takeaway from that place without trying to force meaning into something that just isn't there.
Do you think you'll ever do this again or anything like it?
We would like to. We've talked about, you know, my oldest is 12 now. So we have about 6 years, 5.5 really, till she moves out. And we thought it would be cool to do one more big, you know, family trip. We would do it differently, though. I think we all agree that we would do fewer places slower and just spend more time in each place, because that's where we really experienced the best. It, like I said earlier, when we went slower. And so I think we would all, you know, we've had this idea of maybe traveling for a year, but doing like one country per continent or something like that. So we'll see. But yeah, we'd like to.
Well, I want to talk to you a little bit about your work with Compassion International. They're a partner with the show now. And I told you, I mentioned I just got back from Sri Lanka with them and seeing the amazing work that they do there. How did you start partnering with them?
The first time was back in 2011 when Sean Groves approached me about going on one of their trips back when they were doing online influencer trips. And so I first went to the Philippines, and I had a Compassion kid there in just outside of Manila and got to meet her. And going on that trip basically moved me from being, I don't want to say a casual supporter as though like I didn't care, but a supporter that thought, this is a great thing. Sure, I'll do this too. This is one of the most profound things I can do with my money. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the best ways I can get my family and my kids really to tangibly understand where we are in the world as Americans or just as Westerners and what we are called to as Christians in terms of sharing and what impact we can have. You know, when we lived in Kosovo before we were married, Kyle and I, we really appreciated the work being done there because it was very hands and feet. It was very much like, okay, you guys just went through a genocide and this country is war torn. How can we help? How can we help you rebuild your houses? How can we help you get caught up in school? Those sorts of things. And so we've always had an appreciation for hands and feet kind of work. And to us, this is the epitome of hands and feet work. And so, we visited one of our other kids in Ethiopia as part of our trip. And that was such a great experience to do it with the kids. Cause I had never, you know, last time when I went to the Philippines, it was just me. And so it was so great to have the kids go and to see both like what a difference our otherwise pretty small contribution makes every month, but also how our kid, his name is Abu Becker, how he's so similar to them. Like they just went out and played soccer and goofed around and had similar personalities. And it was so great just to see kids are kids, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah.
So, what is your capacity with Compassion now? Do you go speak places about Compassion?
I don't speak, though I am perfectly willing to if they want me to. I am a devoted partner in the sense that we have three Compassion kids and we love being about it. And I have traveled with them and write about them whenever I can, but that's the bulk of it. It's in an informal way,
right?
But we donate part of our my work from online stuff to Compassion as well.
Very cool. The one thing that I came back from my trip with Compassion was just realizing how well they do things. And I said this in an earlier podcast, like I haven't got to travel much, so I spend a lot of my time here in the States reading about how people help people really badly sometimes. Who wind up hurting the people they're trying to help, or, you know, just don't do what they do very well. And what I was blown away by was how Compassion was so purposeful in at least in Sri Lanka, with giving the people that they're working with dignity and not being condescending in a real, in an interpersonal way, or even in a systematic way as well, just how purposeful they were to those ends.
You know, I think the thing that made me just a sold out hardcore supporter of Compassion is when we went to the Philippines and at one of their largest Compassion center, the leader there said, come on into our, like to me and the other people on the trip, come on into our offices, go through all our files. You are welcome to look through all our paperwork, look through all our, you know, budget spreadsheets and stuff, because we are completely transparent. We want you to know how we spend our money. We want you to ask questions because we want to be above reproach and make sure we're doing this right. And I just thought that is phenomenal that they are not only not trying to hide anything, but they genuinely want to do this right and well. And so to me, I have no doubt that my, you know, $38 per kid per month as of now is being spent so well. And, you know, they do, like, I was blown away, you know, every year we get a little notice like, your kid's birthday is coming up. Would you like to give an extra $20 or so they could get a gift? And my thought has always been like, sure, why not? You know, maybe they'll get, you know, a new basket of groceries or something. No, they literally take the kid to, you know, shopping to get a birthday gift, and then they record it in their note, their journal, their little, you know, file with the kid, holding up a picture of it. And I just thought, that is amazing. They really do good work.
Yeah, that's right. You know, when I first, years ago, when Kate and I first signed up to be a sponsor with Compassion, and we started, you know, they would encourage us to write letters to the kids. And I thought it's a good marketing piece for Compassion, for us to actually be able to, you know, have real life contact with these children, you know. And I thought of it that way, like this is a marketing piece to keep their donors engaged, right? But what I think I discovered this through the years, and then it especially hit me going on that trip, was no, Compassion believes, because it is so, that this is a really meaningful thing for that child in their life. And they, you know, they employ people to translate these letters, and the people who are translating these letters really know that they're doing a very, very important job. And then we got to meet kids who their day was made when they got a letter from their sponsor.
Yeah, I was blown away when we went to one of the a kid's house, and she's actually in the LDS program now, which is like for the older, you know, moving on into leadership positions.
Yeah.
I think I'm saying that right. LDS, or is that something else? I don't know. Either way, that she had the stack of letters that she had been saving since she was little, you know, probably 15 years worth of letters from her sponsor. And she, that was one of her most treasured possessions. Like, she absolutely loved those. And it was so convicting to me, because I think of writing a letter as an afterthought. Like, oh yeah, I'll just drop a note. Sure, we'll do this thing. Kind of what you were saying, almost like, this is marketing. It's great. No, and I've actually heard that they've seen studies, like they actually do better in school. They stick with, you know, the program, and the program helps their whole family. It's not just this one kid. It helps their whole family unit. They stay with it so that their whole family's lives are changed more whenever their sponsor writes them regularly. And we were just reminded of this a few months ago, because Austin had this, I don't know what they call it, but kind of an exhibit where you go through and you experience a day in the life of a kid.
Yeah, I saw that too. It was like kind of an immersion thing almost.
Yes, whatever it was. Well, I went and took the kids, and as soon as we were done, the first thing they said was, I want to go home and write our Compassion kids. And I'm like, good, because this totally convinced me to do it. And my friend and I, who also went, she's like, okay, you and I are holding each other accountable. By the end of this month, we're going to tell each other whether we wrote our Compassion kids. And we just put the letter in the mail, because I was so convicted of how important that is.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
It's the leadership development program that you're referring to.
That's what it is. LDP. Yeah. LDS is Mormon.
Right. There's no Latter-day Saints here. That's what we're talking about.
A little different. Right?
Yeah. Leadership development program, which is awesome. People should look that up. So
yeah.
Cool. So just for those listening, like I said, Compassion is a sponsor of this program. And so people can go to compassion.com/dropout and check out what they do and sign up to sponsor a kid. And I'll have links to that on the show notes and all that kind of stuff. Tesh, it was so good to get to talk with you. I've known about you for a long time. I knew that you lived in Austin, but we've never met. So it was so good to get to spend a little bit of time talking with you. Thanks for coming on the show.
It was great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's at Beard on a Bike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care.
Yeah.